Let's continue our look in Genesis chapter 2 about the creation of humanity. Keep in mind that chapter 1, verse 1, up through chapter 2, verse 3, is about the bigger picture of the week of creation, how God set the whole program up. But when we get to the story that begins in verse 4 of chapter number 2, we move to Moses' inspired account of the creation of humanity specifically. It's not two creations of mankind, but rather the big picture of creation followed immediately by zooming in upon the creation of man specifically. And yesterday we talked about how before man was created, there was no setup of the growing of crops. There was no rain system that was in existence. That God began with man, who was going to then cultivate all those crops. There was vegetation on the earth, most certainly. It had been created in one of the days, but it was in a limited area and had not spread widely yet. But now God is going to pick a place where he is going to set up mankind to spread out from as well. And so we were reading in verse number 7 that he who is God, remember I'm using he who is as the representation of the divine name, he who is God formed the man. And we've got in mind here the very first human being, the one that will eventually be called Adam, which in Hebrew means man. And it's related to the word for dirt. It's related to the word for red. So he who is God formed the man of dust from the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. So God took the physical form, made it, breathed in the life energy of his own spirit into this physical form, and the combining of those two produced an individual. And when we see Ruach, that's the spirit of God, and Nefesh is the idea of individuality. We'll actually see that word, Nefesh, in relationship to animals. But when we're talking about humanity, the Old Testament word nephesh is the same as the New Testament word psuche, which is where we get like psychology and things of that nature. It is about the soul, about the individual thinking person. So now, God has one human being, a male, by the way. And verse 8 says, and he who is God planted a garden in Edom, which that's the way of saying pleasure in Hebrew, in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. So now we've got one human being, a man, who is going to be placed in a very special location on planet Earth. This is a garden, and in the Old Testament wording, this is got in mind a very well-defined cultivated area. And it's God that has designed this cultivated area himself. And it is going to be home to the first couple, and it was intended to be the home to their family as well. But sin's going to come into the picture and cause troubles along that line. Now, where is it located? It says here that it's in the east. And I honestly think that that is Moses' way of referencing that it's to the east of the promised land. So, to the east of the promised land takes us over by the Arabian Gulf. The Arabian Peninsula is on the east side of the promised land, Mesopotamia, the land between the two rivers, dumps into the Arabian Gulf, And I am of the opinion, and that's all it's worth, folks, I am of the opinion that Eden was originally located along the area we now see as the Arabian Gulf. At that time, I don't think it was a wide body of water, but rather a river. I think the flood changed the geography. And this is where I'm going to bring up another time of the supercontinent's existence. Many of us who are creationists believe that the evidence points to God having created one continent in the beginning, surrounded by the sea. And plate tectonics has seemed to bear that out. Even when you look at a map, you can kind of see that the continents fit together like some sort of gigantic jigsaw puzzle that's been mutilated. Some of that is because of the shelves that surround the continents. The theory is that at one point back in time, and I don't think it's nearly as far back as the evolutionists try to say, rather just back before the flood, this supercontinent existed, and you can identify which regions of our current world were located where on that supercontinent. And I would recommend that you check out a place online. I'm not going to give you a particular website. Just run a search of Pangea, that's P-A-N-G-E-A. That's the term that's usually used for this supercontinent. So look up Pangea and current countries or current political map, and you will find, no doubt, some sort of map that shows which countries fit where in Pangea. And you will discover, as I have done, that the Middle East was pretty much intact in Pangea. You can clearly see the Mesopotamian region flowing down in and through the Arabian Gulf out into the Super Ocean. Part of Iran, which is to the north and east of the Arabian Gulf region, is there on this Pangea map. And it's actually part of the shoreline of this ancient supercontinent. So I believe that God located the Garden of Eden on the edge of the supercontinent on the eastern side. And that kind of fits what we're reading here, that the Garden of Eden was in the east. I'll talk more as to why I believe that that's where it was located in a little bit. So God puts him in this garden, and then we have a report of how the garden was designed. Verse 9, out of the ground, he who is God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. So God had already done this. He had already made sure this garden was full of these edible plants. The tree of life was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So God makes sure that this tree of life, which shows up only here in the book of Genesis, and then later it will show up in the new paradise, the new heaven and earth, in the book of Revelation. It is there for the use of humanity to eat from, and somehow it's related to living physically forever. It must have some sort of maintenance effect upon the human body. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil will come into the story later. It is effectively the tool by which God allowed humanity, in this case Adam and Eve, to have the capacity of exercising free will. See, free will is a gift from God to all of us, but it cannot truly be free will unless it has the opportunity of being exercised. So God constructed this mechanism by which free will choice could be made. Now, he already knew, because he's God, and he has foreknowledge, how that was going to play out. And that is why he had already come up with a plan of redemption by which he could provide another opportunity of free will to be saved. And that's what the gospel is all about. All right, so more about those two trees later. Verse 10, here comes a description of the Garden of Eden. And more than likely, we shouldn't think of a little bitty tiny garden, but rather a very large nature preserve. Verse 10, a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and there it was divided and became four rivers. Now, the four rivers actually feed into the singular river. The wording is a little bit clumsy in our English here, but we know how tributaries work. And so we have four different rivers that feed into the singular river, and that singular river flows down and into the super sea. And my suggestion to you is that this super river is exactly where the Arabian Gulf is located today. The place between Iran and Saudi Arabia that whole area, the bay that goes out into the Indian Ocean, all of that, I believe, was the original River of Eden. Verse number 11 now starts naming off these rivers. The name of the first is the Pishon. And I'll come back for an identity on that in just a moment. It flows around, it is the one that flowed around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. Bdellium and onyx stone are there. Now, Moses is writing this many years after the flood. And he is referencing places that he knows exists now after the flood and describes what's in that general region, which tells me that even though the flood altered the surface of the earth greatly, that this particular area did still have certain characteristics that were held over after the flood that could be identified thanks to the leading of the Holy Spirit. And again, we'll get back to some identities of these couple of first rivers in a moment. The name of the second river is the Gihon. It's the one that flowed around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river, and this is where we have some very specific identification that we can use. The third river is the Tigris. Now, that's our more modern name. The Hebrew has the Hiddekel. But the Hiddekel is most definitely the Tigris, which is one of the two rivers of Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is the old Greek way of saying the land between the rivers. The Tigris, which flowed east of Assyria, and the fourth river is the Euphrates, or the Parat, which is the Hebrew way of saying this name. But we know for a fact it is the Euphrates. So we can look on a map and see that the Tigris and the Euphrates come out of the area of the upper Middle East. They come down out of Turkey and Armenia and several stands that are up there. They flow down through what is modern-day Iraq and eventually into the head of the Arabian Gulf. So we know exactly where they're at. And more than likely, they are still very close to their original courses from before the flood. So they are the first two rivers of the tributaries that feed into the super river of Eden that we can identify. Now that takes us back then to the other two. The Bishan goes around the land of Hawilah, which might indeed be the central region of modern Saudi Arabia west of Medina. We have evidence of ancient gold mining in that very area. And there is a river, an ancient riverbed, that flows out of that region into the upper Gulf of Arabia. This is referred to today, these are the names for today, the Wadi al-Ruma and the Wadi al-Batin. They were part of an ancient river system that emptied into the Arabian Gulf just on the northern side of Kuwait, very close to where the Euphrates-Tigris river system empties into the same gulf. So I think that that's probably the correct identity for this river. Then the Gihon, we are told, flows around the land of Kush. Now, some people think that Kush is always Ethiopia of northern Africa, but that is not the case. Kush, as we will discover later, is actually the name of a son of Ham, and Kush was the father of Nimrod, who founded cities in ancient Mesopotamia. And so Kush is also the name of a region in Mesopotamia. And we actually have a character in the book of Judges that is called Cushan Rishathaim. And it has something to do with being from a place called Cush up in Mesopotamia. So the suggestion that I am making, which I've picked up from others, I will acknowledge that, is that this might be the Karun River that is located in modern Iran and which feeds into the Arabian Gulf. And so those four rivers all come into the same area, feeding the head of the modern Arabian Gulf. So if the modern Arabian Gulf is actually the remnant of a river system that existed before the flood. And guess what? We have these scientists who are working with imagery and things of the bottom of the Arabian Gulf, and they are saying there is evidence of a major river system there from way back when the water level was much lower. So, as I was saying, if these four rivers that I've mentioned flowing into the head of an ancient river system that is now at the bottom of the Arabian Gulf, feeding into what we call the Indian Ocean today, but which would have been part of the super ocean of the pre-flood place, then we have a really good description of what we see in the book of Genesis as the location of the Garden of Eden. But it's all underwater now, or much of it is underwater now, or in dry regions of the Middle East. In fact, one of the rivers that's mentioned here that I was talking about, the one that's the, let's see, got to get the right name here. Which one was it? It was the Gihon. Now, no, it's not the Gihon. My apology again. The Pishon. This river system, much of it is underground now because it's in Saudi Arabia, which is part of the empty quarter of that region of the world. Some sort of ecological disaster, probably following up after the flood, dried that whole area out. If you're interested, I would recommend doing a search online for the ancient river under the Gulf of Arabia and see whether or not anything will pop up on those sorts of searches. All right, so back to the text, verse number 15 now of Genesis 2. He who is God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. Now, this is not sweaty hard work. This is before work became part of the penalty of sin. This is enjoyable work. We would think of it as hobby work, the thing that we enjoy doing and we are very satisfied with the results that come from the work of our hands. So God put him in this garden of pleasure, told him that it was his place to make his own. And a lot of the working would have been working with the plants there. Now, since we don't have diseases, we don't have any of the problems that could happen to plants back at that time that they'd have to be working with, then Adam would have basically been trying to get the most out of all of these plants, experimenting with and exploring the wide variety of genetic possibilities with all these different plants. If you think about what people do today that like to grow lots of varieties of roses and they're constantly trying to crossbreed to come up with a new color pattern or a new smell or a new structure of the bush, that's pretty much an attempt to utilize every aspect, every possibility of the genetic code of the rose. That's probably what God gave as an opportunity to Adam. Here's a bunch of plants. Enjoy. Check out new flavors, new smells, new looks. And we would have still been doing that to this day had sin not entered into the picture. And based on some of the scriptures we have in reference to the thousand-year reign of Christ and after, that's probably what we're going to be doing a lot of into eternity, is just exploring the possibilities that God programmed into creation itself. Verse number 16. And he who is God commanded the man, saying, you may surely eat of every tree of the garden. So it's all here for you. You can eat to your heart's content, enjoy all the flavors. It's there for you. But, verse 17, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So the tree of knowledge of good and evil is put there as the mechanism by which Adam and later Eve can exercise their free will. Now, God wanted them to exercise free will in his favor, but had to leave the possibility of them exercising free will against his desires. Because if you don't give the opportunity, you haven't really given free will. And so I know that this is something none of us really like to talk about, but free will is both a gift of God and a great curse to ourselves because of the way that it can be used and has been used. For all thinking persons have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. Every last one of us screwed up when given the free will choice. Now, thankfully, God knew that was how it was going to play out and had already prepared the gospel message. He already had the program in mind as how he would send his son here to become the atoning sacrifice for sin and then give us the free will choice to embrace him as our Savior and Lord. And it is that free will choice that can lead to our salvation and a return to this relationship God wanted with us in the very first place. Now, the wording here can be misleading to many people when it says, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. It is not saying that in the 24-hour period after you eat, you are going to croak. You are going to kick the bucket. The last phrase that appears here is actually a Hebraism. That is a special Hebrew catchphrase or a wording which uses a verb and a participle together. It's the same root. So it actually says here, dying you shall die. And we can look at how this verbiage is used with other verbs elsewhere, and we find out that what it really means is you will definitely die. It means there will be no doubt about it. Not that you will die that instant, but it is guaranteed your termination will occur. And that is going to be a horrible thing that happens to Adam and Eve because of their choice. Verse 18, we'll start setting up for tomorrow's episode. It says, then he who is God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him. So God already knew that he was not going to create only the masculine gender of man. He was going to create both male and female. We know that was part of the original design because that appears in chapter 1 on this topic. But he needs Adam to understand that it is not good for him to be alone, that he needs a partner, that he needs someone that will complete him, someone that is like him and yet different, someone that can make him and her together more than the sum of the two. This is what's so important about marriage. And God sets the stage in such a way as to help Adam and Eve appreciate very much the design of God for the sacred matrimonial pact.